Welcome to Worlds Apart. In the 19th century, war was considered the continuation of politics by other means, but in today's world, that sentiment applies even more to the economy. US policymakers are pretty open about seeing American hegemony and dominance as means to economic prosperity and development, but do they approach it in a sustainable manner? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Jeffrey Sachs, director of the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia University. Professor Sachs, it's a great honor, great pleasure for me to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Now, you've been pretty outspoken about the influence of vested interests on the U.S. domestic and foreign policy, particularly the funding of all the military campaigns abroad. But it looks like the number and intensity of all the conflicts seem to be outstripping the capacity of even the behemoth such as the U.S. military-industrial complex. How did it come to this?
Well, it's very interesting. You started with von Clausewitz, who said that war is the continuation of politics with other means. And I think he was right. He wrote that in 1832. And here we are in 2022, and it still makes a lot of sense. He had a real understanding that these wars don't just come out of anywhere. They actually come out of politics. But you raise a very good question. What is the nature of the politics? So at one level, the war in Ukraine, for example, in my view, is a war of NATO enlargement. It's the United States decided way back when, already at least 27 years ago, when we have one account of it, that NATO would enlarge to Ukraine. Russia, from then till this moment, has said no way. But then comes the question, why does the U.S. do this? And I think that there are two different categories of answers. One is the United States just wants to be the global hegemon. It wants to be the biggest power, and it wants to have its pieces on every place on the world chessboard. The other is that it's business, that somehow there's good business that comes out of that approach. Now, they could be related. Because what is the business? Partly it's the war business itself. That's a $1 trillion a year business, at least, even bigger. And second, by having military bases all over the world, the U.S. thinks that it controls the flows of resources. It gets more oil. It is able to determine where pipelines go, and so on. So there's another view which says that it's politics in the service of the world investment profile.
Well, now, let's focus on that investment profile and the business side of things, because one would think that enrichment or basic greed would be concerned with prolonging itself. They would want their own version of sustainable development to make sure that, you know, the machine keeps operating and churning out profits. Why then, with all the budgetary spending on Ukraine, the U.S. war machine doesn't seem to be sort of fully and effectively availing itself of the such an opportunity as the war in Ukraine, because we know full well that the Ukrainian troops are perilously short on munitions, on weapons, on everything else. If it's just business, why weren't they better about making money?
Well, the interesting thing is the public is sick of this, so the American people don't want our government just spending the money on these wars, which have been trillions of dollars. They see that the budget deficit is huge. The debt keeps rising. They keep being told we can't have health care or dental care or eye care, or your children can't get help for school because the budget is in crisis. And then Biden comes along and says, no, another $61 billion here and $14 billion for Israel and this much for this. So the public's against it, yet it still passes the Senate. And it passes the Senate despite the public opposition, because the senators, by and large, are agents of the military-industrial complex. and they do its bidding. The American people do not think this is a good investment. As their as an economic advisor to them, of course, self-appointed, I will say to them, it's not a good investment. This is a lousy investment for the United States. We're not getting rich out of this. You're not benefiting from this. This is a waste of money and a waste of time and a waste of lives. But it is quite persistent. And one reason why it persists is that when the Soviet Union ended in December 1991, the people in charge and those who came to be in power felt, you know, there's really no obstacle. We can do what we want. So part of it is an incredible arrogance that everything anyway isn't going to be very expensive. These people are not very clever, in my opinion, that are in power in the United States. They've spent $7 trillion in Afghanistan, in Iraq, Ukraine, Syria, Libya. What have we gotten for it? Nothing.
Let me ask you about the people, because the United States prides itself on being a democracy and a model one. And as you wrote, all those failed wars since 2000 have cost the American people around $5 trillion in direct outlays, or around $40,000 per household. There are many indirect expenses as well, like the support for the veterans, the crime statistics, you know, the healthcare crisis, prescription drugs crisis, etc. What allows the American society to be so resilient and to take in so many expenses without clear returns and without much of a policy change? Because I have to tell you that I think in Russia it would not pass. The Russians would not have been so lenient.
Well, it's interesting. You know, first, America, it's an extremely rich country. It really is a rich country. Average income, $70,000 per person. It's a lot of money, after all. It's been very productive, very lucky in many ways, a great resource base. So they're squandering a lot of it right now. Can you imagine a country this rich? And it's like in the Soviet Union in the last years, the life expectancy has been going down basically for the last 10 years in the United States. We have addictions. We have a rise of depression, mass obesity, so many problems. It's because the social fabric is not holding together, even though there's wealth. So the political system does not function properly. It's in the hands of individual lobbies. The Congress is especially corrupt because every congressman spends most of the time making phone calls for money for reelection campaigns. So it's nonstop going to rich people. A few days ago, I was walking home from my office in Manhattan on the Upper West Side, and Broadway was completely closed on one side. When I got home, I found out, well, President Biden was in town. Now, why was he in town? He was in town to talk to rich donors, not to talk to the public, not to have an event, not to meet with the people, but to raise money, because that's what the political class does. Now, that ties in with these wars, because people do make money on the wars, not the public. The public loses. But Raytheon or General Dynamics or Boeing or Northrop Grumman, they make a lot of money and they fund the politicians. And we're told it couldn't be clearer and more crude. The White House puts out maps to the congressman showing, look at the arms factories in your district. Be careful. Those are jobs in your district. You know, it's war as business. Not war, even as politics, like you said.
Professor Sachs, with all due respect, I understand that the politicians are doing that. I mean, they've been doing that for decades, and it hasn't been that apparent to the people. But, you know, I'm surprised that the Americans would take in so much. And I say that as somebody who knows your country pretty well, and I remember that even 20 years ago when I studied there, sure, it was a very prosperous country, but ordinary folks, people working at our university, weren't that rich, and they had to save on gas and on food and on everything else. And I'm sure they're in the majority.
I agree with you. So, you know, the public is quite unhappy. The universities are a bit of a surprise to me because When I went to a university, it was a long time ago, but I started undergraduate 50 years ago, so it's really a long time. The universities were against the establishment. That was the student rebellions against the Vietnam War. Now, the universities are more and more in the hands, actually, of government contracts. The foreign policy centers of the universities are paid for by the military companies. They're paid for by the U.S. government. So I'm surrounded by former government officials or wannabe future government officials who toe the U.S. line. I have a different perspective because, you know, I worked in Russia from more than 30 years ago. I spend most of my time working around the world. So I look at the United States from outside looking in rather than from the inside. I'm not on the team of the U.S. government, but a lot of people are. And that has definitely reshaped the critical thinking. Now, when it comes to the public's disgusted. Donald Trump won the presidency in 2016 as a protest vote. He said he would clean up the swamp. Well, he made more swamps in some places, did other things. He was a very unstable character. We still can't figure him out. Biden is a very mainstream part of the supporter of the military industrial complex in deep state. So we returned kind of to normal. And that has been at the political level. The public is very unhappy. If you ask the American people, who do you want, Trump or Biden? They say neither. Please, can we have another choice? So the politics is not working right now. The political system is really in a crisis.
Professor Sachs, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Jeffrey Sachs, Director of the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia University. Professor Sachs, I'm sure you watched Vladimir Putin's recent interview with Tucker Carlson, and not just you. I mean, judging by the number of views, a lot of Americans are paying attention to that as well. Before we discuss the substance of it, I want to ask a different question because a couple of days later, Mr. Carlson showed up in Dubai, where a journalist asked him what I thought was a very interesting question. He asked whether President Biden understands the law of action and reaction that moves a country like Russia. And I want to ask you the same question, but with regards to the American society. Do the American elites understand what moves the American people and the limits, the red lines beyond which they better not to push? Because with all the resilience of the American society, I'm sure there are certain, you know, basic human needs that need to be met.
I don't think Washington listens at all, either internally or internationally. So Washington could not hear the Russian red lines. In fact, as a matter of principle, if Putin said it, it must not be true. We'll bluff our way, we'll do whatever. But internally also, there is a certain sense that, well, we will create our own narrative, we will create our own reality. The job of politics is narrative creation. It's making the news cycle and so forth. So it's not listening, it's not thinking, it's not trying to find solutions.
Professor Sachs, I'm sorry for interrupting, but it's almost unbelievable to me, because I remember well, like when Bill Clinton was running for the White House, he said it very, you know, publicly. It's the economy stupid, and the American people are known for their pragmatism. They're known for their, you know, material considerations. After all, you're a country that took capitalism to the global level. So there are certain national traits to your country that have to be known and respected by the leaders if they want to keep the country together. What are those red lines, do you think, that the American leaders should be aware and careful about?
Just to tell you, you know, I have argued with this White House as much as they want to listen to me argue about the Ukraine war. And I told them it's terrible. The whole idea of NATO enlargement's ridiculous. But beyond that, it's bad politics for you. So that's what I was telling them, exactly that line. Aside from everything else, this is lousy politics. I say the same thing with the way that these politicians are backing Israel without any constraint as Israel creates this massacre in Gaza. It's lousy politics in addition to lousy policy. They're not very good at this. Biden's approval rating is 37%.
Aren't they afraid of what may happen to their own society? Because, I mean, America has intervened in many foreign countries. It knows what mass protests can turn into. It could be pretty ugly. I mean, it's a pretty dangerous game when you push the society to the limit. I'm not saying the American society is there, but it seems to be moving into that direction if we look at just, you know, basic statistics.
It's been about 30 years since the United States political system has been able to really address any single issue. This is my adult life watching this. We are paralyzed on almost anything, on basic issues, say climate change or energy or healthcare reform or inequality or tax system. It's been basically paralysis for a few decades. It's not even, by the way, the polarization. That's the common phrase that Americans, red and blue, are so divided. That's actually not the problem. The problem is that Washington is paralyzed. It got corrupted by money. It got corrupted by lobbying. It got corrupted by political advisors who think that the idea is spin, not thinking. You know, when the President Putin's interview with Tucker Carlson came out, the dominant reaction was too long. It's rambling, you know, because their attention span is down to 10 seconds or 30 seconds. It's like watching people who cannot think. You look at the major newspapers, New York Times or Washington Post, how they covered the interview. It was all on the most superficial questions. Oh, did Tucker Carlson intervene? Should he have done this? Was the opening history rambling and so forth? Not what was said, what was analyzed. Is it true? How should the U.S. respond? None of that, because there's no thinking going on. It's a game.
You were among the people who advised the Russian government on how to reform the crumbling Soviet economy. And this is a period that is known in Russia as the shock therapy. I know that you advocated against that, you know, punishing austerity, but it happened nonetheless. And it, you know, disturbed the society in a very profound way. I mean, the rates of suicide, the rates of crime, the rates of, you know, abortion, what have you, people were, you know, to some extent losing their humanity in a very, very fast and sometimes very cruel way. I wonder if in a way Russia or perhaps Putin personally are returning the United States this historical favor of exposing that now the American view of the world, the way its economy is prioritized and structured, is divorced from reality. Could that be a sort of a shock therapy, if not hopefully for the American society, then at least for its leaders?
Yeah, just it's worth understanding this very quickly, which is why was I asked to help first by President Gorbachev and then by President Yeltsin? Because when I helped Poland, I said to the United States and Europe and the IMF, cancel their debts, give them some help, create a stabilization fund, attend to the social crises. My recommendation was $30 billion emergency help to stabilize things. And the United States said, flat no, are you kidding? We're not going to help the Soviet Union. Then when the Soviet Union ended in December 1991, and I was literally in the room when it happened in the Kremlin, because President Yeltsin came across the room and said, gentlemen, because it was all men, the Soviet Union has ended. And I said, you know, the United States is going to help you. It's going to help you, Mr. President. And Yeltsin, President Yeltsin said, we want to be a normal cooperative country. And he did. And that was Russia's view. And that's what President Putin said as well. I watched this close up. The United States could not accept yes. And that's, you know, that was my role, trying to help. But the United States was against it. That's why I couldn't do any help. But my point is that what we really learned was that the deeper issue wasn't communism or democracy or anything else. It was the United States wants to be the world power. And if you're another big country like China or like Russia, the United States does not want you there in that way. And that is really the deeper motivation, I'm sorry to say. That's what President Putin says in the interview, in essence, which is that 1991 didn't change all that much because Russia said, okay, we're not communist, we're a democracy, now we want to cooperate. And the United States said, no way, you're still the enemy.
Dominance as an agenda, I mean, if we look at it objectively, it also has to have some business plan to it. If you want to achieve it, you need to calculate the means, the goals, and to make sure that, you know, your balance sheet is in order. From what you're saying and from what you've been writing, it appears that the United States just claims dominance, but it doesn't do any sort of homework to ensure that it has the resources, the capacities, the strategy, the tactics to ensure it. And without it, I don't understand how these people imagine that dominance will stay with them. I mean, it's like it's not just wishful thinking. It seemed to be,
fantasy.
Well, perhaps, yeah. But
yeah. So the answer is first they live in the past. Because the U.S. was relatively more powerful in 1992. Biden clearly lives in the past. You know, he's a man of the past. Then a lot of my former colleagues at Harvard, because now I'm at Columbia and so forth, say, oh, no, we're still the most powerful. They don't look at the data right. They don't understand, actually. And the American people have been told all along, everything's cheap. You can go to take over Iraq. It's cheap. Don't worry. Afghanistan, it's cheap. Ukraine, it's cheap. We can do all of this on the cheap. You don't never have to pay taxes again because all they do is cut taxes and then overextend the military. So the truth is, no politician asks the American people, do you really want to pay for hegemony? And they're all, I think, very naive. I'm not deeply impressed by the analytical power of this security state that I live in. I think they get it wrong. And they are partly bluffing, because if you really look sequence to sequence at the Ukraine war, for example, it was a series of bluffs. The first bluff was, okay, NATO's going to expand. Russia said no. Then came Yanukovych. We're going to be neutral. Okay, the U.S. will help overthrow Yanukovych. No consequence. No, there were consequences. Donbass broke away. Crimea was retaken into Russia. Then 2021, President Putin put on a draft security agreement between the U.S. and Russia. ICE talked to the White House. Take it. This is right. Stop the NATO expansion. Avoid the war. No, we don't have to do that. They thought there'll never be a mobilization by Putin. He won't fight. We can back down. Our sanctions will defeat Russia. You know, it's wishful thinking and gambling. But with our money and our and Ukraine's lives.
Absolutely.
And so I think the answer is there's a group that profits even when it's a disaster. That's the military industrial complex. That's quite powerful. There's a group of gamblers and there's a lot of naivete.
I have one last question to ask you about that interview that Putin gave. At the very end of it, he made a very interesting statement. He said that in his view, the miscalculations and mistakes of the US policy in Ukraine are now apparent. And it is his intuition that the authors of the of that policy sort of want an off-ramp, but he made it clear that Russia is not going to be offering any face-saving measures. Essentially, he said, you know, you created this mess. Think about how you're going to extricate yourself from this. Do you think that's a smart position? And how can the U.S. possibly get itself out of this mess after everything has been said and done?
To my mind, at the core of this has been a mistake by the United States, which is to have a foreign policy goal of weakening Russia and surrounding Russia with NATO. That policy needs to change. If the United States came back to the Russian leadership and said, you know, we really made a mistake. NATO is not going to enlarge to Ukraine and to Georgia. We should end this war. We should find true security arrangements for your region and for Europe more generally. I'm pretty confident that there could be a mutually beneficial solution that would include a viable Ukraine. And that, in my view, is really the case. But in order to get there, actually, there has to be a discussion. And my view is that President Biden and President Putin need to talk. I've said that repeatedly, publicly and privately in the United States for years, going back before 2022. And I will say it again, that you cannot solve this without sitting down. And this is not Ukraine and Russia sitting down. This is the United States and Russia sitting down and talking about a serious way to have mutual respect and to have mutual security, because that's absolutely what's needed for this world.
Absolutely. And one thing I would add is that before sitting down, they also have to sit down and, you know, do their balance sheets and calculate how much money they have and how much money they need for solving all the domestic problems, because this is ultimately what sustainable development is all about, you know, being responsible and thrifty with your national resources and making them serve yourself.
When all of this started, this bravado back in 2000, the U.S. debt was 35% of GDP, the public debt. Now the public debt is 100% of GDP, and the prospects are it's just going to continue to soar. So this is the unreality. Just add it to the debt. And of course, it's deeply corrosive for the long term for the United States.
And yet it's been great to talk to you, Professor Sachs, about those issues. Thank you very much for your time.
Good to be with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.